Welcome to the ESI Report, brought to you by Kroll on Track, the leading provider of e-discovery, computer forensics, and consulting products and services. Your law firm or corporation simply can't afford to ignore the issues that involve electronically stored information. Join us now for the latest in legal technologies, news, and trends.
Thanks for tuning in to another edition of the ESI Report. I'm Gina Gittola, host of this legal technology podcast. Today, we will address the challenges faced by trial litigation teams spurred by the increasing demand to perform more with less and bring to light new and efficient ways to prepare for trial in 2010. In addition, you won't want to miss our Bits and Bytes legal analysis, where we will take a look at the discovery order issued in Pension Committee of the University of Montreal Pension Plan versus Bank of America Securities, LLC. So let's get started with the ESI Buzz, the part of the show where we update listeners on the latest e-discovery happenings, catch up with industry experts, and discuss the legal technology news you need to know.
Now, here's the ESI Buzz.
My guests today are Doug Cohen and Dan Wolf. As a Senior Director of Business Development for Kroll on Track Trial Graphics, Doug works with law firms and corporate clients to identify appropriate discovery and trial service solutions for national, international, and complex litigation. Dan is the Director of Jury Consulting for Kroll on Track Trial Graphics. Dan provides research-based and experimental data analysis to trial teams nationwide and oversees the standards and practice for the trial consulting department. Hi, Doug and Dan. It's Gina Gittola with the ESI Report. Thanks for being on the show today.
My pleasure, Gina.
Thanks for having me, Gina.
As we all know, the stakes of litigation have gotten higher in recent months, and legal teams are under even greater pressure to develop winning case themes and deliver top-notch presentations, though they are increasingly working with fewer resources. This need to do more with less challenges legal teams to redefine current methods of trial preparation and to employ more efficient and innovative methods. Today, we will address how legal teams can capitalize on cost savings, increase team collaboration, and discover valuable insight into their trial venue. Let's begin with a discussion of video depositions and transcript management, which are certainly important aspects of the trial process. Doug, how have these technologies evolved to meet the changing needs of trial teams?
Well, you know, Gina, it's much more common these days for lawyers to videotape depositions as part of discovery, which in and of itself has created challenges in finding an efficient solution to help manage the process. Evolving over the past several years, the trial team's needs in working with their transcripts and depositions have really changed, and they're requiring a lot more flexibility in their tools. So given the constantly changing law firm environment, the tools to manage the tasks associated with deposition review have got to keep up. Trial teams are really looking for smart technologies that allow for streamlined review of deposition transcripts and a video. And they need solutions that can really be accessible at any time from anywhere. With dispersed trial teams and with the increase of joint defense groups, the need for collaboration is constantly increasing, and the old days of using a VCR and some highlighters and maybe even the more sophisticated, locally installed software solutions to review transcripts are just not that efficient any longer.
Given the continued evolution of these technologies, what additional benefits do these innovative applications possess?
Well, web-based solutions and utilizing the web really changes the entire paradigm of how trial teams can collaborate through this process. Web-based solutions allow trial teams to collaborate with internal teams regarding key designations that can be easily shared with the entire trial team and expert, or experts if there's certainly more than one. It removes the cumbersome process of having multiple paper copy sets made for each reviewer and reviewing each designation line by line. Multiple users can also be logged in at once and can gain access to the work process at any time. And trial teams also benefit from fast and reliable access to streaming video. I think for lawyers and for trial teams, it's important to look for the level of support that they need. Some firms, you know, want the comfort level of knowing that there's around-the-clock support, or they make the decision that they want the provider to create designations or custom lists for them. And underlying all of this is they've got to be able to access this from anywhere via internet connection. So with the web-based solutions, you're not restricted to having to VPN into your firm's network, and you can even work on some airlines that provide internet access, which is another way to ensure maximum productivity.
These technological advances are sure to help streamline video depositions and transcript management processes for trial teams. Doug, are there any cost benefits associated with these technologies?
Well, certainly different solutions provide different pricing structures. So it may be most beneficial to use a provider that charges per case rather than per user. This ensures that any member of the legal team can participate in the deposition review process without your firm or your client incurring significant user and storage fees. Also, a web-based solution reduces the administrative headache for the firm by reducing or eliminating the IT infrastructure support or resources that are required. It doesn't take up server space, and it doesn't create any unnecessary overhead for the firm, such as locally installed solutions might.
We've had a great discussion so far regarding the availability and benefits of trial preparation technologies. But let's switch gears and discuss the value of venue research. Dan, why is knowing key demographic information regarding the venue for which you are trying your case important?
Well, as you know, Gina, there are really many uncertainties that a trial team faces when trying a case, particularly in an unfamiliar venue or a remote venue. And this is what really leads to a lot of anxiety that trial teams face when they are in their trial preparation efforts. And two of the most important things that we have found that a trial team really needs to know are, one, what are some of those key demographics of, quote, the typical juror that you might find in the venue? And secondly is, what important information does a trial team really need to be aware of when trying a case in a particular courthouse or in front of a particular judge? And as we have found, any experienced trialer would know that a juror's demographics may help shape their decision-making process as it relates to their arguments. Certainly, it's not a be-all or an end-all to juror profiling, but we know that these readily identifiable characteristics such as gender, age, ethnicity, household income, and even voter preferences are all factors that can contribute to a juror's profile. Certainly not any one of those in and of themselves will be predictive of things like verdict outcome, damages being assessed, or the like. But in combination, these things are characteristics that any lawyer would like to have access to in knowing what there is in a particular venue. And so certainly knowing this information in advance and having it readily available is certainly one way to gain an advantage over your opposition. And additionally, factors such as courtroom layouts and diagrams help provide the trial team with insight into how the room will be set up and where the jurors will be seated, the judge and witnesses. And this certainly will enable you to be well prepared in advance of trial so that you can really maximize the impact that you're going to have on the judge or the jury. And with these recent advances in technology and these online solutions, there are really numerous online resources available that will help lawyers who require this insight to help them gather that information, utilize it, and have access to it without really spending numerous hours and investment and cost and resources that's necessary to get that information.
Thank you, Dan. Now, are there any cost savings associated with using an online resource tool for demographic information?
Absolutely. You know, there's savings from both the time and cost standpoint. First and foremost, you no longer have to send paralegals or associates to research this information. And we found on average that you can estimate a time savings of approximately 4 to 6 hours per courthouse, again, depending on how experienced your team is and how readily available the data or information is. You know, obviously, this translates into real dollars saved. You know, you could be talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars spent on research alone. And in addition, when using an online tool to access this information, you aren't, in effect, really freeing up those resources to provide support for the trial team to concentrate on those tasks that are directly related to preparing the legal arguments for the case and the trial preparation efforts that they were truly designed and prepared to do. And another benefit that's really realized from an online tool like this is the inherent time savings realized by having all of this information quickly accessible at your fingertips. And moreover, there those inherent efficiencies that are built into these online tools will not only save time in the researching, but also certainly save costs for any outsourcing that may have been incurred in doing this in the past.
It certainly seems there are plenty of opportunities with venue analysis and transcript management to cut costs. The graphics creation process also presents a time arena for increasing efficiency with the trial team. Doug, how have technologies in this sector evolved to create effective and impactful graphics while saving time and energy?
Well, Gina, any experienced trial lawyer understands the importance of visuals to help communicate key themes and messages of their case. However, for years, law firms have really struggled with the time-intensive process of manually revising and communicating their presentation. In this current environment where there's such an emphasis to improve efficiencies and manage costs, it has become more of a necessity to streamline the review and collaboration process with team members. There are solutions available today that allow trial teams to utilize the internet to comment directly onto graphics during the creation process. So working in a web-based tool allows for a real-time element of submitting graphic comments and accessing new visuals as they're completed. In other words, there is a constant real-time workflow without the time delays inherent in email communication between the legal team and their provider and printing out the latest version of the graphic, marking it up, scanning it in, and sending it back. This makes it a lot more efficient.
Doug, Dan, unfortunately, we've reached the end of our show. Dan, do you have any final thoughts regarding the landscape of trial management in 2010?
Yes, Gina, thank you. To recap some of the key points of our discussion today, there are really three things that you'll want to keep in mind for trial preparation as you face this year and beyond. First, we really encourage you to take advantage of the latest web-based online solutions, which, as Doug has discussed, are much more cost-efficient, easier to manage than a locally installed solution. Secondly, these online tools really lend themselves to increased collaboration and streamlining of the workflow process for your transcript management, graphics creation, and gathering particular information related to venue demographics and courthouse or judge information. And third, and finally, locating these new tools that provide easy and efficient access to juror demographic data and the courthouse information are really essential to trying cases in 2010 and the coming years.
Doug, Dan, that sums it up nicely. Thank you both for being on the show. I'm glad we've had the chance to discuss these emerging trial management technologies and techniques. That was Doug Cohen, Senior Director of Business Development, and Dan Wolf, Director of Jury Consulting with Kroll On Track Trial Graphics. For more ESI news, visit the Kroll On Track website at krolontrack.com to sign up for a free monthly newsletter.
Corporations and their counsel are faced with managing a new world in legal discovery, electronically stored information. Through its consulting services, software technologies, and computer forensics and electronic discovery solutions, Kroll On Track offers the skills, strength, and unfettered commitment of a trusted expert. Now, back to this edition of the ESI Report for today's Bits and Bytes Legal Analysis.
In this edition of Bits and Bytes, our legal analysis focuses on the facts surrounding Pension Committee of the University of Montreal Pension Plan versus Bank of America Securities LLC, which revisits the landmark Zubelake series of cases and defines preservation obligations. Kelly Kubacki, Kroll On Track legal correspondent, is here to fill us in. Kelly, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Gina.
Kelly, I understand this opinion comes from the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York, with Judge Shira Scheinlin authoring it. Can you tell us more about the parties and the facts involved here?
In February of 2004, the plaintiffs, who are a group of investors, brought the suit to recover losses of $550 million stemming from the liquidation of two hedge funds in which they held shares. The defendants in this case were the former directors, administrators, the auditor, and the prime broker and custodian of the liquidated funds. Now, of the 96 plaintiffs involved in this action, only 13 were relevant to this specific discovery dispute. During the discovery process in October 2007, the defendants claimed that the plaintiffs' document productions were severely lacking. And as a result, and in response to the defendants' requests, the plaintiffs were ordered to provide the court with declarations regarding their efforts to preserve and produce documents. Based on this information received by cross-referencing the productions and declarations of the plaintiffs, the defendants were able to identify at least 311 responsive documents that were not included in 12 of the 13 plaintiffs' productions, and discovered that nearly all of the declarations were false and misleading, or executed by an individual without personal, relevant knowledge of its contents. Armed with this information following the close of discovery, the defendants moved for spoliation sanctions and dismissal of the plaintiff's complaint.
What specific preservation obligations were violated by the plaintiffs in this case, and what sanctions, if any, were imposed?
Well, originally, all 13 plaintiffs relevant to this action failed to issue a written litigation hold when the duty to preserve arose in 2003. Seven of the plaintiffs eventually did issue a written hold in 2007, while six of the plaintiffs failed to issue a written hold at any time. After defining the meaning of negligence, gross negligence, and willfulness in the discovery context, the court noted that following the final Zublake opinion in July 2004, the duty to issue written litigation holds was clear, and that the plaintiff should have instituted a written litigation hold no later than 2005, which is when the action was transferred to the Southern District of New York. The seven plaintiffs who eventually issued written litigation holds were found to have acted negligently, while the six plaintiffs who failed to issue any written litigation hold were found grossly negligent and subject to a permissive adverse inference sanction. In addition, the court found that all 13 plaintiffs were worthy of monetary sanctions since they had conducted discovery in an ignorant and indifferent fashion, and awarded the defendants reasonable attorney's fees and costs associated with the motion.
Why has this opinion, and in particular Judge Scheinlin's definitions of negligence and gross negligence in the discovery context, received such a significant amount of attention within the legal community, Kelly?
Well, Gina, the strong reaction from the legal community in response to this opinion stems from the specificity of Judge Scheinlin's definitions. At the outset of this opinion, Judge Scheinlin notes that a court's decision to impose sanctions in any given case is a fact-sensitive determination dependent upon a judge's gut reaction based on years of experience. However, Judge Scheinlin then goes on to list specific actions, including the failure to act, that constitute negligence and gross negligence in terms of discovery when the duty to preserve has attached. Accordingly, the following failures are defined as gross negligence by the court: failure to issue a written litigation hold, to identify the key players and ensure that their electronic and paper records are preserved, to cease the deletion of email or to preserve the records of former employees that are in a party's possession, custody, or control, and to preserve backup tapes when they are the sole source of relevant information or when they relate to key players, if the relevant information maintained by those players is not obtainable from readily accessible sources. Now, by contrast, behavior such as the failure to obtain records from all employees, or the failure to take appropriate measures to preserve ESI, or to assess the accuracy and validity of selected search terms, or even the failure to collect evidence, constitutes simple negligence.
A party's culpability seems to be an important factor for the court to consider when determining if and what sanctions are appropriate. How does this relationship affect a party's burden of proof?
Well, you're certainly right in your assessment, Gina. A higher degree of culpability, for example, willfulness or gross negligence, as opposed to mere negligence, does have a direct effect on the severity of sanction imposed. In turn, the severity of the sanction directly relates to the burden of proof required to be met. For less severe sanctions, such as an award of costs and fees, the court's inquiry will focus on the spoliating party's conduct instead of the loss of evidence and whether it was relevant or resulted in prejudice. Essentially, the innocent party must prove three elements: that the spoliating party had control over the evidence and an obligation to preserve when the evidence was destroyed, that the spoliating party acted with a culpable state of mind, and that the missing evidence is relevant. On the other hand, when more severe sanctions are considered, such as dismissal or adverse inferences, the inquiry of the court focuses on behavior as well as relevance of and prejudice caused by the unavailability of the evidence. Moreover, if a spoliating party is found to have acted in a grossly negligent or in bad faith, relevance and prejudice may be presumed. However, Judge Shinlin makes a point to note that this presumption is not required and is always rebuttable.
The burden-shifting regime advocated in this opinion seems to place a substantial burden on innocent parties, even in the face of spoliation. What was the court's reasoning behind this decision?
Well, Judge Shinlin acknowledged that requiring an innocent party to demonstrate the relevance of evidence that it may never review due to the opposing party's failure to preserve seems unfair. However, she goes on to say that the party seeking relief has some obligation to make a showing of relevance and prejudice, lest litigation become a gotcha game rather than a full and fair opportunity to air the merits of a dispute. Indeed, an automatic presumption of relevance and prejudice would motivate parties to find errors and capitalize on mistakes, which the judge felt would not be a good thing. In summary of her discussion on this issue, Judge Shinlin sets forth a burden-shifting test, and the test is as follows. If a spoliating party's conduct is egregious enough to justify the imposition of a presumption of relevance and prejudice, or if the conduct warrants permitting the jury to make that presumption, the burden shifts to the spoliating party to rebut that presumption. If the spoliating party demonstrates no prejudice occurs, then no jury instructions would be warranted, although the possibility for lesser sanctions remains open.
After this opinion, the duties of counsel as they relate to e-discovery seem even more concrete. What are people in the legal community saying about this case?
Although at the outset of this opinion, Judge Shinlin notes that in the complicated world of electronic discovery, courts cannot and do not expect that any party can meet a standard of perfection, she also made clear that courts have a right to expect litigants and counsel to take necessary steps to ensure preservation and proper production. It has been stated that this opinion provides the criteria a court should review in evaluating discovery conduct. Now, much of the legal community has interpreted the opinion in this case to raise the bar of acceptable conduct for attorneys within the discovery process. Some go as far as to say that this case alone establishes criteria upon which counsel can evaluate their own conduct and effectively creates an inventory of e-discovery do's and don'ts. Because of these implications and the definition of certain discovery behaviors constituting particular levels of culpability, commentators consider this case to be epic in the world of e-discovery and a must-read decision for all litigators.
What lessons arising from this case are particularly important for corporations, law firms, and really anybody potentially involved in litigation?
In the context of e-discovery in this day and age, ignorance is simply not bliss. Judge Shinlin makes a point to note that the standards of acceptable conduct relevant to the discovery process have been set by years of judicial decisions analyzing allegations of misconduct and reaching a determination as to what a party must do to meet its obligation to participate meaningfully and fairly in the discovery phase of judicial proceedings. Failure to conform to the standard, as stated by Judge Shinlin, is negligent even if it results from a pure heart and an empty head. Although the specific definitions of unacceptable conduct and relational levels of culpability are not meant to establish a definitive list of conduct in the discovery process that will result in sanctions, the message from this case is abundantly clear.
Thanks, Kelly. Another fascinating case with many advisory points for anyone with ESI discovery responsibilities, whether in a corporate counsel's office or in a law firm. That was Kelly Kubacki, Bits and Bytes legal correspondent. Hey, listeners, did you know Kroll On Track offers a free online library of thought-leading ESI legal resources? If you're looking for upcoming legal technologies programs or recent ESI case law, visit krolontrack.com/legal resources. Well, it looks like we've come to the end of another great show, and I'd like to give special thanks to today's guests, Doug Cohen, Dan Wolf, and Kelly Kubacki. And thanks to our first-rate legal research staff, including Kelly Runkel, for helping us put together the show. Join us next time as we continue discussing cutting-edge ESI issues. Until then, I'm Gina Gittola, reminding you that when you think ESI, think Kroll On Track.
Thanks for listening to the ESI Report. Remember, to help you manage electronic information accurately, defensively, and cost-effectively, it pays to develop a trusted relationship with a legal technologies consultant who can address your business needs. Visit www.krolontrack.com/contact us to learn more about KrolonTrack's e-discovery, computer forensics, and consulting services today.